I'd like to call this talk Learning to Fly. This morning I had a conversation with an old friend that reminded me of a story that I love that I'll tell very briefly. The story is basically about a party, and I'm going to make my own version of the story now. So the queen and the king were having a party, and they were deciding whom to invite. And they invited those that they wanted to invite, and they didn't invite those that they didn't want to invite. So they did not invite Chaos to the party. And Chaos was a known power of the time, a kind of, we could say, demigoddess. And she found out about the party, of course, as Chaos will. And what do you think she did? So she obviously went to the party, uninvited. And the guests did not appreciate her contributions. So we could imagine what she did at the party. We know what she does to us when we reject her. I think there might have been some poison in the punch, for example. So a memorable party in the wrong kind of way. So I just remember the friend who told me this story, who was a kind of rapper, like a Dharma rapper. He just said, just remember, always invite Chaos to the party. I like how this kind of retreat helps us keep the question open of whom we're inviting to our party and why. And to keep the question open about whether we could manage to invite Chaos this time. Knowing what happens when we don't. Every time she finds her way in. With the quest for true rest, we need to invite Chaos into our discussion. Once we have a taste, or once we hear that it's possible that it might be allowed to rest, we would like to bottle it and have it to keep. We'd like to figure out the formula. We'd like to figure out the rules for how to make rest stay with us and make ourselves stay with rest. And it is exactly that part of us, that tendency, that wants to formulate, that is so tiring, that's so draining. I would like to tell you a true story that if you've been in this room before, you might have heard it before. But maybe you love it as much as I do and don't mind. It's about Jacques. Jacques Luceron was a French boy in the part of the story I'm telling you. When he was 8 years old, he lost his vision in an accident. He was no longer able to see with his eyes. And he was a boy, it's not a sad story. He was a boy who loved seeing. He loved light. He used to play with light. He used to run around on the sidewalks of Paris and in his apartment building playing with light. And then he lost the ability to see. And part of why it's not a sad story is that apparently neither of his parents ever said, "Oh, how unlucky. Oh, what misfortune." And so it was acceptance of what was, of what had happened, and of what was happening. But still, Jacques really wanted to see, when he went to the park with his father a couple of weeks after the accident, he wanted to see that tree that he loved in that park. And he wanted to see it so much that he did. He saw it. He could make out its shape and its color. It's not that he suddenly regained the use of his eyes, but he could actually see it. And he was happy. And he was so happy that he started to play with this gift that had happened from his longing to see the tree, to meet the tree by seeing it. And he started to find a way to be able to see. And it was an inner connection. When we talk about deep rest and letting go, when we talk about deep rest, then we talk about, or we experience sometimes, letting go and relaxing and releasing. And sometimes the question comes, where does the rigor, is that a common word in English? Where does the rigor come from, come in? Where does the, maybe discipline, we could say, where does that unstoppable movement towards depth come in, and how does that fit with just relaxing and being loose and letting go? And so for Jacques, it was, he loved the tree, he wanted to see the tree, he couldn't see the tree. And because there was not a sense of shame about not being able to see, he didn't stumble there, which is where we, I think, stumble. Because we didn't, our parents did say, "Oh no," probably, or whoever said, "Oh no, what bad luck. That my child is hyperactive, or that my child is so shy, or that my child is whatever." And so we also now say, "Oh no, I'm so shy, or I'm so angry, or I'm so whatever." So if we can kind of fluff that shame, give a little bit of space between the feeling and the shame, the experience and the shame, so that we can more easily feel our deep wish, the way Jacques wanted to meet the tree, our deep wish to meet life, and let it be as strong as it is. For some people, it's stronger than for other people, and it just let it be as strong as it is. Also, unashamedly. And let the rigor be there with staying true to that wish to meet life fully in this life as soon as possible, as much as possible. So that could mean now. So Jacques found that he could see when he was in a world that was friendly. When he was in a world where he didn't need to be first at the game, when he was in a world where he didn't feel insecure, and when he started to feel fearful or competitive, he couldn't see anymore. He stopped being able to see. I know this sounds very strange if you haven't heard the story before. It's a true story. The truth is unconventional. Luckily, does not live by our laws of what's possible, what's right, what's wrong. And so he could actually see, and I'll just give you one example. When he was older, about 18, I think, he would go hiking with his best friend who could see. And so he would keep a hand or two on his friend as they hiked, but then he would tell his friend, "Look down in the valley at that lake just beyond those dark trees." And his friend, who had the use of his eyes, would look and see the lake down in the valley behind those dark trees that he hadn't noticed before. But it was just as clear as his seeing what helped him to be able to stay connected and see, and what made him stumble and lose the ability to see, to lose what he experienced as an inner light that allowed him to feel and see the shape of things and the color of things. Does it make sense, even though it's maybe bizarre? And so sometimes we close our eyes because there is so much to see that, like the seeing friend, we don't notice the lake down in the valley. We close our eyes so that we could be open. To our world in a different way. Our world that includes us. Sometimes there's such an abundance of color and shape coming in. That we lose touch with our deep wish to be here. And the sense of how here needs us to be here. It doesn't require us to be here, but there's a place for us here, and it needs us. Does that make sense? Here needs our presence and our power. It doesn't mean we need to do something particular, something special, something unconventional to prove that we're here. But our courageous willingness to be open to here needs, this world needs. So if we can't quite feel the preciousness of our own need to meet life fully, maybe we could feel how precious we are to life. And how just by being here more fully, a little bit more fully, it can make a big difference all around. It could be just that lightness of touch in the room that allows others to take flight. And so just this morning in the connected movement, just only towards the end, it felt to me like enough of us were courageous enough to just be simple with the connection and the movement. And a particular freeing quality came available, I felt, in about the last 3 minutes. So thank you for that. And I'd like to talk a little bit about that quality as part of learning to fly. So if our only rule could be staying true to that connection or brightness, that connection that allows us to see with our true eyes, to see with the eyes of our deep heart, if that could be our only rule, if we need a rule, our flight will be as different as the flight of the airplane and the flight of the buzzard. They're almost always both of them in the sky here, I noticed. So you can lie on the grass and receive that. I'm happy that the airplane flies and brought me here. I'm happy that humans have learned how to get this huge chunk of heavy stuff up into the sky, but we should remember that it's not that humans have learned to fly. We've learned how to get this big heavy thing up there and back down, usually. Usually both. And in that flight, as smooth as it is, we could see that chaos has not been invited. And in the flight of the buzzard, so when you, just any bird up there, it doesn't matter if it's a buzzard, those big birds, in that flight, chaos is involved. Without chaos, there wouldn't be that soft sailing across the sky. Part of inviting chaos is that readiness to be like Jacques' parents, that even when something terrible happens, it's not bad luck. It's not something wrong with me. It's not something I did wrong. Or even the boy who caused the accident that he necessarily did wrong. Imagine. That is probably the big step that we can do. That's maybe where our doing could be involved, is to shake off the blaming, the blaming mood that our culture is in. And so, preferably not as a rule, I was saying that kind of tongue in cheek, but as our love and our need, staying as true as possible, as true as we can, to something in us that is meeting life fully and wants to keep meeting life more fully and more fully. So there's a different mode. It's not like yesterday was that full, 86%, and today we're at 84%, and I want to get to 90. It's not that kind of more full and more full. It's fullness upon fullness. And what's possible today is enough. Even if you think it's only 1%. If we let it have us, that wish to live fully, that fact that there is some fullness of living going on already, if we let that have us, let that take us. Even if it seems to be 1%, it's enough to help us glide. I want to read some words from Khalil Gibran. And I want to also use this book as a part of this talk. This book was given to me as a prize when I was about 12 years old at Trinity School, where Jennifer also went in Atlanta. And at 12, I didn't get much out of it. And it's curious, actually, because then the fact that I had owned it so long, by the time I might have been ready for it, more gave me the sense, well, I already know that book. It's been on my shelf since I was 12. And so the day before yesterday, coming here and seeing it, I was looking for a bird book for my son, and I saw this, and this came to me. And it's breathtaking. And you probably have heard the part about children and parents. I think it's even a song, a 60s song. They're not ours, but they come through us, and we're the bow, and they're the arrow. It's true, but we've now heard it maybe too many times to get shaken up by it. So in a way, well, yeah, I'm really happy that I only really met this book 2 days ago, because it's now been so long ago that I can be open to what it's saying. And I could just read this book to you and not say anything else, and I would be happy with what I'd said. Today, I just want to read something that where he's talking about laws. The context of, it's actually a story as well, where there's a wise person who's been away from his home for a long time. And he sees that the ship is coming for him finally, and he can go home. And he feels a little pang of, after all these years with these people in this land, can I just disappear? And he feels not quite. And then the people start begging him to say something to them of what he sees and what he knows before he goes. It's a little bit, it strikes me as a little bit like Lao Tzu. He's leaving China, and at the border, someone begs him, please say the unsayable. And so in the story, different people ask him, please speak about love, please speak about giving. Oh, I actually copied it down by hand, almost the whole 4 pages today. It's so delicious. And when the lawyer asks about law, the prophet in the book is called The Prophet, says, you delight in laying down laws. This is so lovely. Yet you delight more in breaking them. But don't take that as a criticism. That's not in the book, but don't take it as a criticism. You delight in laying down laws, yet you delight more in breaking them. And then he gives the image of children playing by the sea, making sand towers, as he calls them, delighting in making them and delighting even more in breaking them. And what if there's nothing wrong with that? Usually we might feel a little bit like, oh, that child is very aggressive. I would do differently with my child. That's the kind of thought I had before I had children. It's okay. And then he closes that image of the children, us children, playing at building and breaking down and laughing as we destroy something that's made to be destroyed. And when you destroy them, the ocean laughs with you. Verily, the ocean laughs always with the innocent. So first, just to get the happiness of the possibility of making kind of, okay, guidelines and intentions and what I want to live by and how I want this day to be in line with my higher self. And this kind of really helpful, I find, really helpful use of our will. And then equally delighting when chaos comes in and you want it to be peaceful. You really, really want it to be calm. And something else happened. And what if we just laugh at the flimsiness of our own will? Okay, yes, but also at the how limiting it could be to say, all I want to do today is be calm. Then that would not allow us to fly. If I know I love calmness, then I can love calmness right through my own complete freak out. And laugh. And not say, oh, bad luck. So then he goes on, the prophet in the book. To talk about someone or those people, but I would say that part of us that loves law and rigidity more than life. He describes that part of us as also standing in the sun, but with our back to the sun. So what we see is our shadows. We have the evening sun to help us visualize. The part that refuses to look at something that bright. And so therefore all I see is a shape that's dark. And what the prophet dares to say here, the prophet, the fictional prophet who's really Khalil Gibran, the writer, telling us everything he knows, that our laws, which include for me even those really, really good intentions, where it becomes a should. I should be calm. Not that I love calmness, but I should be calm. Is like tracing the outline of my shadow, which is all I see. That's what's in front of me. So those who stand in the sun but with their backs to the sun see only shadows, and their shadows are their laws. So sometimes when we feel frustrated, when we thought that that good intention was going to be what made me fly, that finally fixed my wings and gave me a lift, and the frustration when it doesn't seem to be happening, when we pretend to fly, but we know the view has not changed. It might be a simple but radical turning around, turning away from even my best intentions, and being open to what helped me find any kind of form, any kind of outline, which can be a lot like closing our eyes, turning away from what can come across as so busy and so too much that we go numb. Just closing the eyes to feel what is my response, for example. Not what I thought I should, what I thought that good intention would look like. Turning away from that shadow, my vision of how I should be, or how they should be, or how it should be. And where did that good intention come from? Why did I like that good intention? Why did I choose it? What is it made of, kind of? And that's why this book is part of a talk before I cover it up again. Things that we've gotten so used to that we don't open them, and we don't open to them when it's absolutely, literally breathtaking what's in here for me. And so staying true to our own way of deeply seeing, even when we can just barely make out where's the table, where's the door, where's my bed, where can I rest, where can I work, where can I get in and out. If we could try not relying only on what worked in the past, not relying only on what we've read, not relying only on what we think looks right, not relying only on what we think looks nicely rebellious, also, whatever version of right. Most people's experience when they, I think I could say truly most people's experience, but let's just say many people's experience, when we shake off all those dusty ideas and visions and shoulds, those laws, that wish to exclude chaos, and to only, for example, another phrase from this book, to only experience love's pleasure and love's delight, and not love's rigor. He doesn't use the word rigor there, but. To also be, as he says, to feel the pain of too much tenderness, to feel how raw it is to be open, to be truly open. Many of us only at first feel the rawness and the shakiness of being kind of undressed. We feel like a chicken that's been plucked. So how are we going to fly? And everybody else seems to have nice feathers on. And so I'd like to talk about two things that I've come to experience very much unexpectedly. I was not expecting this in the last year. Through playing with the kind of connected movement that we did this morning. So if you weren't there, no problem. I'm not giving you a guilt trip or anything. But it's just very simple. Today what we did is we felt the physical heart and tried to get inside it, feel it, really its volume and weight, as well as its aliveness. Kind of letting go of our anatomy book picture that even if we've never looked at an anatomy book, we somehow seem to have. And really get into the living thing, which it is, a living thing. And then just simply moving, having that connection and letting the body move. So I kind of want to apologize for being unconventional. I almost wish, for those of you it's your first retreat, I could just give you a more conventional Dharma talk, but here we are. So this practice of connecting to something in the body and then moving is a great remedy for what can and does happen when we try to be still and be aware of something physical, the belly, the back, whatever. When we try too hard to be aware of the breath or the belly, for example, what we tend to be cultivating is not awareness. It's not even really kind of open attention. It's really usually control and censorship and usually criticism. So then it's that thing of not inviting chaos. We have a guest list. We have a, what is that called? The guy at the door. It's usually a guy. Yeah. The butler too. We have the bouncer and the butler, if we can. I invited you, but I'm not coming to the door to let you in. And then it feels pretty dead in here. And so having the chance to have a complementary practice of connecting to something undeniable like a knee or a tailbone and moving rather than being still, it can unveil a kind of awareness that's not controlling or less controlling. It feels, in comparison, like not controlling. And through playing with that, and just very simply on my own and connecting with other people who are interested in that, and sharing our experiences, I found two experiences that come through that I had never heard, I have still never heard anyone else talk about. And they seem to me they seem to be crucial to the chance to be fully human. So I'm sorry, this is going to be really weird for you. Please try it on your own once you've heard me talk about it. In being in touch with certain organs inside and moving from there, so one example is the kidneys, which are actually way up here. We were all, I think every single person in our little lab group were surprised that they're not down here by the hips, but they're up here by the bottom of the rib cage. Just being in touch with the kidneys and moving, there was a very clear sense, which has come many, many times since then, of what I understand to be osmosis, which is when there's a cellular wall, or I would say, I don't know if this is technically osmosis, but there's also an organ wall, and there are liquids, there are things passing through the wall. And there's usually exchange. It's not usually, it would be hard for it to be in one direction. It's usually in two directions. So in my mind, I have no other word than osmosis, reverse osmosis. It may or may not be that, but it's a very clear feeling of exchange across a boundary. And it's a mutual exchange through what seemed to be solid, but seemed to be not communicating. It seemed to be a defining border. And I think there's some importance of playing with this, being in touch with the body and having that experience, because it's such a felt sense of what I think life is, which is generosity, which is many-directional generosity, which is generosity that's not thought through. It's generosity that happens by itself and ends up being more enriching than we could even understand, much less pre-calculate. And I had this really funny word game pop into my mind about this, and about this, again, simple but radical shift from the way we've been taught to live, which is about getting our money's worth, for example, making the most of things in a particular kind of way, in a way that we're determining, we predetermine. I want to go on that retreat in order to. I think even with the example of coming on retreat, it's perfectly valid. I'm going to spend time, which is even more precious than the money, which also it costs to be here. It's perfectly valid to think of, well, is it worth going? Is it worth trying it out? Even if I know there's not a guarantee that I will connect. That's fine. It's not like that's now illegal. There's a new law. But I think if we think that's all that's going on, which is our training, to think that's all that's going on, we miss all the other reasons, incalculable reasons, that brought us here. And they are also important, and probably more important. One example is how you're here to enrich us without trying to. You don't have to do anything special. But by being here, you already have, and you will, and you do. Bring us food that we need. It's a kind of sweeping feeling. Like, it does feel to me a lot like how I imagine wing on air or feathers brushing past each other. And so the word game that came to my mind was our trained thinking, the way that we've been trained to think is to, someone recently sent me an example of an account sheet and what he would like to make for Open Dharma for the year. Where, and I was like, uh-huh, I'd like that too, good. There's the income, there's the total, and there's the outgoing. And so I was laughing to myself that on an account sheet, when we're keeping count, there's the income and there's the outcome, which is the outgoing. So that's my mind gave this cute, like, Indian style game. We think that, first of all, the income should be greater than the outcome. The income should be greater than the outgoing. We should we should get the good deal. And since we've had the experience of being cheated, and we have that experience pretty much, I guess I would say, every day in a culture where advertising is part of our daily life, we get cheated every day. Someone who doesn't want the best for us is playing with our mind outside our zone of awareness and attention. So we have all had the experience of being cheated, and so that gives us even more fuel for our thinking that we need to make sure that the income is greater than the outgoing. And I guess the word game is probably obvious, that if I think I'm calculating income and outcome, what I'm mostly limiting is the outcome. I'm limiting what I'm going to receive by having a specific set idea of what I came for. I think I only came for that, then that's the maximum I could receive. And there's so much more than that that we're receiving. If we could acknowledge that, it is mind-blowing. It's hard to take. It's good. It feels good. So this is part of what has been beautiful in this discovery through working with the body and moving, for me, is daily examples of how good it feels, how hard it is to take, how good it feels, to be in tune with, let's say, the flow of our transformation, to be in tune, in alignment with that longing to live fully, to meet life, to embody aliveness. Does that make sense? Is there any question yet? Or comment? So just being open to the way that we are bigger being, are what they call in the Zen tradition the big mind, is or might be brushing up against, osmosing with the big mind of the tree, of the sky, of each other. And that exchange is incalculable. And it feels good. And when we let a border be that open, we're inviting chaos. And that's real. It's a real thing. There are ways that our shielding of ourselves, it doesn't keep us safe. There isn't safety. But it does keep us blind to how unsafe we are. And that might be comforting sometimes. If we could, we can allow our deep wish to meet life fully. We can allow that to include a wish to be safe. It's not like we should wish to be unsafe. We can wish, that can be part of it. I wish for safety. And that's part of the traditional practice that we did this afternoon. Often the first statement is, may all beings be safe. Even if I know it's actually impossible, but I still wish it. Okay, so then we can start to feel this simple radical shift from trusting how I calculate things to be and trusting what's trustworthy, where chaos is included. Where I can do my best to bring safety. And so it's not my fault when unsafety happens. This is one thing I noticed that, again, I have never heard anyone talk about, not that I've been able to travel around to hear that many teachings in the last few years, but when I had a big explosion of emotions and things coming from my past where I had been sexually abused as a child, when I was about, let's see, how old was I? 21 and 22. It took me a while to first kind of find any kind of steadiness with the amount of unsafety that I experienced. The way that as the evening would come and I would need to, or I would feel it would be nice to go and close the blinds of my room, which was on a busy street in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And the terror I would feel and the images that I would see in my mind of being gunned down. And then finally getting there to just close the blinds of the window. And after quite some months of that and quite a lot of lovely people being in my life as well, it was a small and simple, helpful realization that someone could climb up from the parking lot on the other side of my room and get in the window and hurt me. And it wouldn't be my fault. And when I said that in a Dharma talk, I think the only other time I said it was in Sarnath many years ago in India. And I was really surprised to see people nodding, women and men of all ages. Not everyone, but knowing what I meant. Feeling how our strategies of defense get in the way of our coming into trust, what's trustworthy. So the terror and the images of what might happen were not making me safer. And the hesitation to get up and close the blind. Was not something to rely on. But the good feeling of letting go of that overprotectiveness, Khalil Gibran uses the word overprudence, over carefulness, that guard, that, I'm going to call it bumper, that bouncer, butler. The possibility that my intuition could be enough to tell me if this is a good place to be or not. And that my mind is not the one to tell me. The fearful mind gets it wrong time after time. Does that make sense so far? Any questions? Okay. So, leaving the boundary less guarded can allow this nourishment, this mutual nourishment, this exchange that feels good in and of itself, even when it's painful, to stay open. And even when it's pleasant, sometimes that's harder. Sometimes we can say, okay, this is painful, but it's openness. But when it's so pleasant, so delightful to allow exchange, sometimes the turtle goes in its shell again. And that's also not bad luck. It's just something to where we could feel the pain of so much tenderness towards ourselves and towards our human situation. And then the second main discovery that's come through during this last year or two, playing with connecting to the body and moving. So connecting to the body in a different way from what I have done in all the years before. And doing it a few minutes a day, most days. So not like intensive, but also pretty steady. What came through, especially in connecting to particular organs, so for example, the stomach, so maybe we'll do that one tomorrow morning, just the stomach, that thing, that bag, that bag of juice. The first thing that was really interesting was that among the 6, 7, 8 of us that were playing with this year together, connecting through internet to share our experiences, it took us, I think it was about 3 weeks before anyone had much to say about it. It was pretty hard for all of us, strangely, to feel that we really connected to the stomach and moved from there and felt anything of interest happening, other than the resistance to connecting and moving from there. And then there started to be a kind of tumbling into an utter softness. And it was or is so soft. The feeling is like powdery soft, feathery soft. And maybe you might find a feather and actually feel how soft it is. So it's not just, I know feathers, you know. Don't tell me about this, but actually feeling how soft. And then with the softness, a definite sense of sensuality or sensuousness. Maybe partly sexual, but not quite so much sexual as sensual, sensuous. Very pleasant. Very pleasurable. Very slinky kind of movement. And even if the body wasn't moving in a slinky kind of way, there was a sense of so fluid that it's beyond water in being that fluid. So maybe more like the way air is also fluid. And what was striking then was to see how interesting that it took us all, and we were all in different places around the planet, Australia, Maine, Spain, California, I think, or wherever, New York, shyly joining the group document to say, well, still don't feel much. To me, it seemed to be an obvious kind of statement, a statement of the obvious. We don't sense that we're allowed to or that we're safe if we're in that softness and that sensuousness. But in allowing a sense of exchange, of openness of our borders, allowing us to be raw and kind of naked of the shoulds, the pressure, so that's a practice, coming again and again out of the pressure when you can. If we could know that it's not just about rawness and kind of bearing the rawness, the sense of being exposed and vulnerable. It's also where that the actual experience, not the idea, but the experience of our actual vulnerability is also delightfully, unutterably untamably soft. And that freeing ourselves into that softness, I have the image of like freeing a fish into the wide sea. We could imagine a little fish that just got used to the aquarium, or a big fish that got used to the aquarium. That's what there was. And then when there was something wider, at first it could be startling, and we would know that we didn't know how to be in so much space, and we would be right. But that after a while we might remember without trying to, we might let it come back because we need to, a way of moving that's trustworthy, that is unpredictable. So it includes chaos and it includes pattern. And one image from this book called The Prophet is that it would be like melting and being like a running brook that sings its melody to the night, as well as knowing the pain of too much tenderness. And when the rich person asks the prophet in the book to speak of giving, I think now this makes me realize that right here, what I want to share with you is so far my favorite piece in the book. There are those who give, and, well, let me back up and give you the whole, the flow. There are those who have little and give it all. These are the believers in life and the bounty of life. And their coffer, their bank account, is never empty. There are those who give with joy, and that joy is their reward. And there are those who give with pain, and that pain is their baptism. And then this is the part that has a lot to do with what I've been trying to speak about, that is in each of us. And there are those who give, or that there is that in us that gives, and knows not pain in giving. Nor does that part in us seek joy, nor give with mindfulness of virtue. How biblical and archaic is this? Can you hear what he's saying? So not even seeking the joy of giving, not feeling any pain in the giving, and not giving out of a should, out of being good. They give as in yonder valley, over there, the myrtle breathes its fragrance into space. Through the hands of such as these, God speaks. And from behind their eyes, from behind those eyes, God smiles upon the earth. Feel free, if it helps you, you can replace God, that word, with any other word. We could say life or aliveness also. Through those hands, I don't like for you to think that it's that other person over there who's so free. That part of you that knows this, that innocence, that gives just like a myrtle breathes its fragrance into space. Through those hands, in those moments where that happens, that is pure aliveness speaking. Through those hands, from behind those eyes, pure aliveness smiles on this earth, in this earth. Which may say better than I said about how here needs us, likes us, is friendly with us, as we are. And also knows and calls forth that in us, that uncontrived unfolding. Is there any comment or question?
Yeah. I like the imagery of the fragrance of the myrtle because it's so toxic. Happens.
Yeah. Great. Thank you. Could you hear? Yeah, great. I also like that. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad you say that, because that's also this exchange that I was talking about. Mm-hmm. It's not the kind of giving or exchanging that we think of. Any other words?
It seems like it would take trust in something to get over the fear of being more open.
Yeah. Trust your experience. And know that how you calculate your experience is usually not true. Really taking into account the moments where there was trust in something ungraspable, in what's trustworthy, and how that flowed. Taking that into account. Yes, thank you. I didn't pull that together. Yeah. And so it's that we're flying without even saying, even to myself, I'm flying. It's just soft and good and wide perspective. Where those eyes and those hands can reach everywhere like they love. Something else? Something else? Thank you for listening. And normally I would suggest that we would just be quiet together in the hall until the end of the time, but it feels like it might be good for some of us to get outside and walk or lie down or stand. So feel free to be here or outside. And if you're in group B, we'll meet in about 10 minutes up by that glorious big tree by the dining room.